To the Property Tax and Local Government Division for the day. And I will call the meeting to order. And I believe the first bill on the agenda is House File 2242, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for bringing House File 2242 before the committee. And this is a bill that some on the committee may remember from if you were engaged with the bipartisan Small Business Caucus in our last term, because we went through a really extensive process that time, going through all kinds of different proposals. We heard everybody's, kind of like this committee, and the tax committee hears a lot of proposals. And it was one of the three that we, on a bipartisan basis, agreed to it, move forward as a priority. And what it does, and there's been some confusion about that, so I want to make sure people understand, this is only dealing with the state levy, the amount that we collect the property taxes that goes into the general fund. So it doesn't have any impact on the taxes that go to your city, your county, your school district, your special taxing jurisdictions. It is only about how we decide to divvy up the state add-on, as it were, to the property tax statements. And what it does is for the first tier of commercial industrial property, that's the first $150,000 of value, that is exempt from the statewide general levy. And instead, then it applies at values over $150,000. The end result of this, and because the hearing, I just have to say I am so impressed with and always delighted to work with Mr. Hines, who can make those computers dance really effectively. But the break-even point where a property or a business owner would get at least a break-even would be $1,170,000, as I recall. And so all businesses with values under that would definitely get a benefit from this by shifting some of the burden to the higher value businesses. And the rationale for that is coming out of the recession, even during the recession, there was a lot of good economic data that showed our larger businesses, because many of them do a lot of exporting, so they're in a more global economy, oftentimes weathered the storms better than some of our small mom-pop businesses who tended to ride with the unemployment of the local economy. And there is a handout, the breakdown of the state commercial industrial property. Do you have that shows the current law and the what it would be under House File 2242? And you'll see there's a little bit of shifting between the metro and the non-metro, as you would expect, because the metro has a lot more properties that are worth more than $1,170,000. And but it does provide $80 million in property tax relief to our smallest businesses, which are oftentimes cited for being the best at generating jobs, which I think is still a worthy goal for us to continue to pursue. And it does that within this state levy and not within others. I will be honest that if you happen to be a tenant of a gigantic, you know, $25 million office tower, you know, and you pay your property taxes via your rent, you're not going to get the direct benefit that if you owned a piece of property on Main Street that was of lower value would. And, you know, I think that's consistent with the fact that we reward homeowners who invest in a community and put down roots by owning something versus renters. We give them a little better deal for making that investment to an area, and I think this reflects that same thing. And with that, I would be glad to answer questions. We do have some testifiers.
Oh, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, how did you select the level of $150,000?
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, that is the first tier. And so I'm not adding new classifications. We've always heard, in fact, I had someone today suggest that we should add a third tier, and you know, and I said, well, you know, we're kind of into streamlining a little bit, and if we're going to do anything more sophisticated than that, we probably need to wait for another day. But that was the basis, so that it's already an easy break point. It will benefit those of higher value, like I say, up to $1,170,000, but it's an easy way to just calculate the levy.
Representative Torkelson.
So if your business is worth over $150,000, can you explain the effect?
Sure. You would pay Thank you, Mr. Chair. You would pay zero taxes on the first $150,000 of value. And then you would pay on, say you had a property that was worth $300,000. You would pay a slightly higher rate on that extra $150,000. But until you reach $1,170,000 in value, you're still a gainer or neutral. At the neutral point is $1,170,000 in value. Beyond that, the shift is larger than the break that you get for the first $150,000. So even the IDS Tower will get a break on the first $150,000, but they have a lot of value beyond that.
Good afternoon, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome. We were just asking questions before we went to testify.
Very good. Do you have any testifiers that you wish to...
I would like to invite Ms. Audrey Britton up. And she's going to share the testimony as well as a small business person who couldn't quite rearrange the schedule fast enough.
Got it. While she's coming up, Representative Erickson, do you have questions for the author?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, I do. Representative Loeffler, about how many small businesses would fall under this change?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, I'm going to have to look to our esteemed staff to see if that was one of the things they were able to pull out of their computer banks.
Esteemed staff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I guess the short answer is I don't know.
All right. Ms. Britton, welcome to the committee.
Thank
Please
you
state all. Your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, my name is Audrey Britton, and I am a board member of Small Business Minnesota and its government relations director. And just briefly, Small Business Minnesota is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, statewide membership association of all small business owners. I should say association of small business owners here in Minnesota. We offer public policy advocacy, educational forums, networking, and small business resources. And I was going to say I'm here with Jim Kellison this morning, obviously, or this afternoon, obviously. This isn't Jim Kellison, but he could not rearrange his schedule quickly enough, but I will read his testimony, if that's all right, later on.
Certainly.
After quickly researching House File 2242, we were chasing this down today and didn't have all the numbers, but what we could see, we support the property tax relief bill that specifically benefits small businesses throughout the state. And we have heard from several of our own members that property tax is a heavy burden, and this includes members in the Twin Cities, the Fourth Ring suburbs, and in Greater Minnesota. When the profit of a small business averages about $40,000 a year, every dollar counts. And small businesses are a major force of our economy. They contribute more than 50% of the GDP, and collectively, small businesses are the state's largest employer. Yet the vast majority of business-related public policy continues to favor big business. So in House File 2242, we see a bill that focuses on addressing a small business concern, and we thank you for that effort. And if I can move on to Mr. Kellison's
Certainly.
Testimony. So Jim Kellison is the owner of Kelco Services, LLC. It specializes in office, medical, retail, and manufacturing building services. They offer a variety of things from land acquisition to engineering design and everything you could think of you might need in those building trades. So he did most of the research on this, and he said after reviewing and researching House File 2242, and based on his knowledge of commercial property taxation, which he had quite a bit, he offers his support of this bill for the benefit of not all but many small businesses and property taxpayers in Minnesota. So he's also a board member of Small Business Minnesota, and he says he feels comfortable endorsing this legislation on behalf of the membership of Small Business Minnesota, who are all small business owners here in the state.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Britton. At this time, I'd like to formally convene the committee since we now have a quorum, and the chair will move. Where Oh, yeah.
2240.
I don't have to move it. You do it, Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 2242 to bring it before the committee for consideration. And before we go to the next step, I will just mention that I had a chance to talk to Mr. Kellison, whose written testimony was just submitted, and I think he would not want have any discomfort with my saying that he rents a tiny office, he said, in a gigantic building, and he personally wouldn't see the value probably much for his business, but that he really felt that for the a major number of small businesses, this would be a good step forward, and he would support it, even though he was a tenant in
Thank
a very large building.
I have on the list Mr. Dwayne Ahrens. And on deck, Ms. Jill Larson. Mr. Ahrens, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Chair and committee, I'm Dwayne Ahrens. I am the new Director of Public Policy for NAIOP, which is the Commercial Real Estate Developers Association. And I just wanted to be on record as actually being against the Representative Loeffler's bill. Of shifting some of the taxes to the higher value buildings, many of our members have some of those high value buildings, and they have lots of very many of those small businesses in their buildings, and we just think that would be an unfair burden to actually shift on to the higher value buildings, and so with that. We just want to be on record as against it, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Larson? And now on deck, Mr. Jim Kellison? Or is he the gentleman that...
The
written testimony.
Yes.
Thank you,
mm-hmm.
Representative Erickson. Ms. Larson, good afternoon. This before.
Mr. Chairman, yes, thank you. I'm Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. You asked me to be brief, and so I will. I would like to echo the comments from NIOP. We also have concerns about this proposal because it does just simply shift the tax burden on to other properties. We don't oppose if the legislature chooses to provide additional property tax relief to small businesses. Our concern is that it is just going to increase the cost to other businesses. And as was mentioned by Representative Loeffler, even small businesses that are in large buildings will be negatively impacted by this, including, I think, Mr. Kellison's business. So thank you. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Representative Hertas, do you have a question for Ms. Larson?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
All right. All right. Please proceed.
It is as much a comment. I think oftentimes we're trying to help, and the unintended consequences is that we're not helping. And as in the case of the testimony we just heard from NAIOP, we have many larger buildings that house or have tenants of small business owners in there. And the dynamics of leasing commercial property, oftentimes you're paying rent with a net, meaning that these large buildings pass on directly the increased property taxes in the form of rent. So if you're not big enough to own your own building, you're going to be actually burdened by this bill, which will pass on those increased shift of taxes to the smallest business owners. And if I had my druthers, I would rather that we, unlike what we've been doing for the last 20 years in creating 55 different property tax classifications and shifting burdens around, that we make it a level playing field and everybody is subjected to the same rules.
Thank you. Ms.
Chair?
Oh. Yes,
if
Representative Loeffler.
Respond to that. Because the value that's even just a break even is over $1 million, $1.2 million basically, the majority, I think, of small businesses actually, even if they don't own their own building and a net lease, will still benefit because they will, if they're responsible for the property taxes on their portion of the building or the whole building, if they rent the whole thing, that will flow through to them. With this break, the properties that would be more would not get a break would be the ones who are you renting in a very expensive building, which is a trade-off in terms of making a business choice about where you decide to where your best market is, where you should locate. But I personally believe that most of our small businesses start out small in small places, and that this would really help a lot of our main streets. I don't know about yours, but mine have a lot of vacancies, a lot of small commercial industrial properties that are older, that are really struggling to attract and retain tenants. And I think this will actually help spur some people who are interested in an entrepreneurial, you know, effort to step up to fill up some of those vacancies.
Ms. Cadoon.
Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Ms. Cadoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Here to express our concerns with this bill. We're certainly supportive of reducing business property taxes. We do have some of the highest business property taxes in the nation on commercial properties, and we certainly are supportive of reducing it. However, we do have concerns with this bill due to the $80 million of shifting that will occur among business properties. We think this will have a disparate impact around the state. We also believe some small businesses will benefit, which is good, but also some small businesses will not benefit. There'll be a tax increase for many of those businesses. I think the total shifting is unknown. If there's some runs, I would love to see them, to see if we really know how this might play out around the state. We do believe and would be certainly supportive of lowering the overall state levy. Might be a good way to make sure that you're actually reducing property taxes without having that shift that would be occurring. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify either for or against House File 2242? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate the committee's consideration, and I do believe that this is a way that we can help some of our communities that have a lot of vacancies emerge and help some of our small businesses perhaps add to their payroll, and I would hope we'd seriously consider it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Lean, I believe you've got two for us today. Representative Lean, which bill would you like to take first?
Mr. Chair, let's start with House File 2975.
All right. Would you like to move that to be before the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Please
House
proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2975 basically a permanent appropriation for the Border City Development and Enterprise Zone Program. This would be a $5 million annual appropriation, and this is not a new program. This has been in place since the late 70s, and it came about when some folks were noticing some of the disparities in the business climate in terms of property taxes, economic development incentives for Minnesota, North Dakota, and sought to really help out some communities on the western side of the Minnesota border. And last year, we did put in $1.5 million. That was a one-time appropriation for the biennium. I really think, though, we do have a situation right now where the time to act and make this a stronger program is right. And I say that for a couple different reasons. First off, we have an instance where Minnesota's economy, quite frankly, is growing. And I think it's really appropriate timing to really seize on that growth and really leverage some of that growth to make it even stronger. North Dakota's continued economic boom from oil production plays into things very, very largely here. This is really the first time ever where North Dakota has a trajectory for some real long-term growth. I know they've seen some boom and bust economic cycles with the oil industry lately. And they're really on track right now to really progress at quite a fast rate here. Right now, they're producing about 900,000 barrels of oil a day. Their 2012 GDP, that was the most recent number I could find, 2012 GDP growth was at 13.4% compared to Minnesota's 3.5% and Wisconsin's 1.5%. And also, I think this is the right time to act as well, because the North Dakota legislature won't be meeting until 2015. So this gives us an opportunity to be really proactive with our 2014 session here. Lastly, you know, I really think this is important for not just the border cities on the western edge, but also all of Northwest Minnesota and really all of Minnesota to start taking advantage of some real economic opportunities going on along the western border. And this bill, House File 2975, is really taking a look at the future of the border city programs and what I see potential there, not just for Minnesota growth, but also combating what I see North Dakota being poised to do in terms of even further property tax reductions and even more increases for economic development. And with me, I have the Assistant City Manager of Moorhead, Scott Hutchins, to provide some additional background detail on the program and answer any questions.
Excellent. Mr. Hutchins, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Scott Hutchins, City of Moorhead. Thank you very much. As Representative Lean notes, we're at a critical juncture, we feel, as we continue to provide a competitive playing field for existing business as well as attract new business in and participate in what is a certainly growing Minnesota economy and what appears to be an exploding North Dakota economy. And having the permanency of an appropriation will help us sustain our existing business base as we provide services to reduce workers' compensation costs, which are disparate between Fargo and Moorhead, and as well as East Grand Forks and Grand Forks, and also to attract new business. And we participated, certainly some, and the Border City Program has been integral in assisting us in growing our community. And this would be very beneficial, because much of the growth and expansion, is so often said, comes from existing business space. 70 to 80% of business growth occurs from your existing business base. And in this case, Fargo, North Dakota is the 800-pound gorilla just across the river with a tremendous and well-diversified economy. Businesses there are growing continually, and we want to be able to attract and participate in the attraction when they're looking for alternative sites and locations. And we think that Moorhead and Dilworth and the rest of the border cities in our area of Minnesota is an attractive landing spot for some of these business expansions, but we need to have this relatively competitive playing field. And just recently, for example, and I'm sure Representative Marquardt will note this, the city of Dilworth was able to attract a global firm to Dilworth to deal in medical testing and pharmaceutical testing, occupied a vacant facility, a rather large vacant facility, in town, and this program and the appropriation and these dollars were put to good use to attract that company. So thank you for your consideration this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchins. I often think of former Representative McFarland, who was a legislator from the East Metro, and her family owned a tire store, I believe it was. Yes. And she would often contrast what the state over the years has done to attract new businesses versus what it does to help incumbent businesses.
You bet.
And was always a voice for, we've got these folks who are already here providing jobs and part of our communities, let's do more for them. Mr. Representative Lean, are there other testifiers?
Nope, it was just Mr. Hutchins that was able to make it today.
Okay, fair enough. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lean, would this funding be available for other border cities? I think of Halsted, who competes with my hometown of Hillsboro. They're very close. And if, as you move up, Climax, Pearly, and on up the Red River, would this be available for them as well if they have the desire to develop an enterprise zone?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson. The existing statute for this program applies to East Grand Forks, Moorhead, Dilworth, Breckenridge, and Ortonville. But that's certainly a conversation, you know, I'd certainly like to have in terms of what we can do for all of Northwest Minnesota, not just for the disparities, but some of the opportunities that are present from all the attention that the North Dakota and Western Minnesota region is receiving. I understand that's kind of beyond the purview of this committee and this conversation here, but I'm certainly opening and looking to start that conversation as well.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Well, we could begin mining in our state more aggressively in those areas of the Iron Range.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, for the House File 2975, is that what we're on right now, or 3030?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And so, to the author, how is this different than when Representative Lanning did in 2011 and 2012? Is this the same version of this?
Representative Lean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gravel, excuse me, this is largely the same program. That would have been a one-time appropriation that Representative Lanning had carried in, so this would be a permanent appropriation.
Thank you.
Representative Gruff.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lean, when Representative Lanning carried the bill, what he told us was that this would be used so that we could be competitive on property taxes. That was the recollection I have. Is that the purpose of this goal, of this bill today?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Garofalo. That is a part of the program, our property taxes. Also, cities can use it for business growth, attracting new businesses, as well as helping businesses retain or hire new employees. So there is a wide variety of uses for the program.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lean. Is it fair to say, because the way Representative Lanning framed this to me when he was carrying this bill is that that the property taxes, because of the energy resources over there, was a competitiveness issue. That the property taxes, because of the, you know, no fault of their own, unless we design the Slant Oil Drilling Company in Minnesota and start stealing oil from them, that was the chief driver for this, is to make sure that property taxes can, at a very minimum, stay where they're at, as opposed to having North Dakota constantly cut taxes and have that be lower. Is it an economic competitiveness issue?
You know, Representative Garofalo, the chair took a train across North Dakota last summer. It'd be an awfully long straw to get from the Minnesota border to the Bakken oil fields. It's a long ways.
That'd be called a pipeline?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Garofalo, again, this bill, there is a wide variety of uses for this bill. I do also have on the agenda today House File 3037, which seeks to target the commercial industrial property taxes in a little more precise way than the Border City Economic and Development Zone Program does.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Garofalo.
And Representative Lynn, the reason why I ask is because it would be entirely consistent for Representative Lanning to bring this forward, but I'm confused about your advocacy for this because there's a lot of cost differentials between Minnesota and North Dakota. A higher minimum wage, a higher income tax. Right now the top income tax rate in North Dakota is 3.99%, I think about 4%. But now in Minnesota it's just short of 10%. On top of that, we've got the business-to-business sales taxes. So explain to me why those higher mandated costs for businesses in your community are good, but this higher mandated cost is bad.
Representative Garofalo, be careful about making fun of North Dakota because you'll remember what happened to Representative Dean. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Garofalo. That's certainly a concern in my district. We did see an instance where a couple of businesses actually moved across the river in the last year. Now, I actually made calls to those business owners and kind of asked them, you know, okay, what's going on here? And their response to me was that it was not so much about the tax differences between the states, but about specifically West Fargo having some renaissance zones, some economic development dollars, basically, that they were able to put forward for these businesses to move to West Fargo, take advantage of some of those programs, and in turn build new facilities and some of those things. So, you know, I think from what I'm hearing, at least businesses in my district, is that it's largely an issue of the property taxes, but also that the cities of, again, Fargo and West Fargo just have more resources for economic development.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lean, thanks for bringing this forward. I think the Border Cities, like you said, started in the late 70s, and actually before last session, the funding had stopped for Border Cities. And the disparity reduction credit, who is the one that really relates to property taxes, that hadn't been touched, at least in the 13 years I had been in the legislature. So thanks to Chair Lincheski and Chair Dabney and Representative Lean, not only was the $1.5 million restored for border cities, but there's actually a 17% cut for business taxes in Moorhead. And so that was great to see. But I think when you look at some of the competitiveness, and one of the reasons why we had border cities in the first place is that Minnesota's a cold weather state, and so what we do statewide has been very successful in the past. You know, a lot of investment in education and workforce, and that's paying dividends now. I mean, you look at 50,000 new jobs this last year, 2.8 million people in the workforce, the largest ever in the history of the state. And as Representative Lean had mentioned, well, North Dakota's like at 13.4% increase in GDP. Even Minnesota at 3.5, that was the fifth highest in the nation at 3.5, but shows how North Dakota is so out there right now with all of that oil. Lots of oil in a small populated state, just boom. And then, you know, Wisconsin and Iowa is 1.5% growth, and South Dakota's like 0.3. So, you know, Minnesota's doing well, but when you look at North Dakota, North Dakota last year lowered property taxes $500 million. Now, in proportion, that would be like us lowering taxes about $5 billion. So that's what we're facing. So keep the same game plan that's working for the state, but because there's a unique condition, especially along the North Dakota border, you know, East Grand Forks against Grand Forks, Moorhead Dilworth with West Fargo and Fargo, and Breckenridge with Wahpeton, you need to have some of this unique legislation. And on the border cities, what that's been used for, Moorhead's used it to buy down the differences in workman's comp. Mm-hmm. Dilworth has used it to hold up over years, and then, as Mr. Hutchins just mentioned, be able to give lots of money to this national, international company that came into 120,000 square foot vacant building that it's at vacant for a few years. It's going to be huge for Dilworth. So it's kind of like if you're a football team that's really successful, you don't completely throw your game plan out, but if they do something differently on the other side, you will do something that week to adjust your game. And I think that's what this is really doing as far as the border cities. But it's unique with what's happening in North Dakota right now. It's just unbelievable. And yet Moorhead and Dilworth and all those cities gained population the last census. Things are growing there, but it's and we used to have the property tax advantage until the $500 million of increase, because Moorhead always would do a study and look at it, and actually things came out pretty even, weren't they, overall, where, because as you mentioned, income tax were higher and some other things, but property taxes were lower in Minnesota. But now with that $500 million, you kind of lost that part. So
right.
This, especially the next bill too, would be really, really vital to lowering business property taxes. So it's a well-needed program. Thank you, Representative Lean, for bringing this forward and all your work on this.
Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify regarding House File 2975? With Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lean, what should I tell my constituents in my district with regard to their businesses who have to compete in the same type of competitive environment, where in the case of independent warehousing facilities that do fulfillments that have to compete with North Dakota or South Dakota, compete with Wisconsin? What makes being on the border such a unique position that if you have a place at the business table of tax breaks, that it works and it's okay on the border cities but not elsewhere in Minnesota? What do I tell my constituents that that they don't deserve to have the same rules to play with?
Representative Lean, what's distinct about the border cities area?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas. you know, like I say, this has been an issue that people have taken note of since the late 70s. I mean, we've been having this conversation for the last 35 years, and really it's just, we really do have a very unique situation, a unique set of circumstances where you know, I don't know so much that the state of North Dakota can take credit for their economic growth right now because of some of their policies, as much as it is they found a massive oil play. They struck oil. And so, you know, I think that's the uniqueness of this situation, is that North Dakota is really an outlier in terms of what it's able to do right now, what its economy is able to do right now. And so for us on the border having to compete with that, you know, I think that's where this conversation comes into play.
Mr. Hansen, you want in on this? And then Representative Lean, closing comments.
Thank you very much. While there may be impact broadly throughout the state from particularly this economic boom in North Dakota, on the border, in this situation, we're dealing with basically a single business environment. The customers are within the two counties that Moorhead and Fargo and West Fargo and Dilworth share. Businesses have free rein to the access to those customers by moving on either side of the border. So it's a very, very contained environment. And the basis for this program was a statewide study that analyzed broadly the state of Minnesota, all of its borders, and noted that out-migration of businesses reduced personal incomes, and other factors were shown and demonstrated along this border with North Dakota because of just the disparate policies. And you're right at the point of joining and operating in a single economy, if you will, and the competition is very, very keen.
Representative Lean, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your time and the division's time here, and this has proven to be a successful program for economic development along the western border, and I'd appreciate your support to continue that and make it stronger.
Thank you, Representative Lean. With that,
Mr.
we'll
Chair,
lay over.
I'm sorry. Just a quick question. I've been thinking about this all this conversation. How exactly then is the money distributed? Is it if your city has 20,000 employees and Dilworth has 5,000 employees, on and on? It's just a per capita amount.
Which one of you is best for that? Mr. Hutchins.
Mr. Chair and members, the funding is distributed amongst the border cities on a population mm-hmm. basis, pro rata population.
Representative Rundeck.
Mr. Chair, of employees.
No. Mr. Hutchins.
Population.
Oh. Population. Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. With that, we'll lay over House File 2975 for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Lean, would you like to move House File 3037?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Very good. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and division members. We largely went through the story, some of the situations, and the situation that we're dealing with on the northwestern Minnesota border. And so this is just one more extension of the border city programs and seeking to make the northwest Minnesota border more competitive for business development. This does target House File 3037. Does target the commercial industrial property taxes much more than the broader border city program. This program was started in the late 1980s, and we did do some things last year to reduce commercial industrial property taxes from 2.3% down to 1.9%. Granted, the values of the business stayed the same. It was about a 17% decrease in property taxes. This bill, House File 3037, would seek to bring that down to 1.5%, so that would be an additional 21% decrease. And, you know, again, I just think that this is really crucial for us right now with Minnesota's improving economy going on right now, to really build on that, and also taking a look at what I anticipate North Dakota doing even more for property taxes when they enter the 2015 session. As Representative Marquardt stated, they did reduce property taxes across the state by $500 million, so, you know, that'd be roughly $5 billion on a per capita basis for Minnesota. Taking a look at some of the property tax rates from across the Red River, that would be equivalent to about a 22-25% reduction in commercial industrial property taxes.
Thank you very much, Representative Lean. Mr. Hutchins, do you wish to testify on this bill as well?
Mr. Chair, members.
If you do, please identify yourself for the tape.
Excuse me, Scott Hutchins,
right.
City of Moorhead. This reduction that you're considering from 1.9 to 1.5 would level the playing field significantly, but not achieve even the effective tax rate of CI property in Fargo and West Fargo. As Representative Marquardt pointed out, this last go-around of reductions drove their average effective tax rate to 1.32. But we find Minnesota's a marvelous place, Moorhead is a marvelous place, and if we can sell our other amenities, neighborhoods, industrial parks, infrastructure, services, if we can be at the table, if we have not been shut out of the conversation because of wildly disparate property tax levels or other kinds of considerations, then we have a more than fair chance of telling our story and on occasion businesses and industries and the like will locate or expand in our community or other places in Minnesota. So this gets us closer to the effective tax rate levels in North Dakota.
Thank you, sir. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you for your patience.
I appreciate it. And unfortunately, I can't stay for a long debate because there's a coal energy standard bill up in the Energy Committee.
All right. Representative Lee, any closing comments?
But I have to tell you, Mr. Chairman, that I do want to ask my colleague, Representative Marquardt, or perhaps Representative Lee, I am genuinely confused about the position on taxes here. Because last session, we were told that you could raise business-to-business sales taxes, you could raise income taxes, you could raise the minimum wage, and there wasn't a competitiveness issue. However, this session, one of the first things we saw was a repeal of those business-to-business sales taxes, an acknowledgement that there was a competitiveness issue, that in fact it was a mistake. And now I'm hearing from Representative Lane and Representative Marquardt that, no, things are fine. We don't have a tax problem. So I just want a straight answer. Do we got a tax problem up in the border communities of North Dakota with our income, sales, and the regulatory cost structures of Minnesota versus North Dakota? Do we or not?
Representative Marquardt, you seem to be looking at you.
Yeah, no, very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, when some of those sales taxes were passed last year, let's remember we had a $600 million deficit. We still owed the schools $800 million, and then we actually wanted to put some good investments in some important areas. So now with the surplus, we can eliminate some of those, which we have in whatever House file that was, Representative Lencheski. The House has done just that. But no, my point is along the border is that as Minnesota, I think we have a very successful philosophy and game plan that has served the state very, very well. But when you're up against a state that just is doing what it's doing right now, you have to have some uniqueness. And I think Mr. Hutchins hit it right on the head, is that people aren't just going because of the tax rates. I mean, there's all the other amenities, but you have to be in the ballpark when it comes to property taxes and some of these other things. And if we weren't next to North Dakota, if we were next to some of these other states that weren't booming, it'd be a different thing, and you might not need the program, seriously. But with the situation that we have right now, it is just so unique. I mean, like I said, the property taxes, we had somewhat of an advantage in Moorhead and Dilworth and along those, but that is really gone just because of what they've been able to do. So, no, the game plan's good, but there's unique situations that at least stay in the ball game so you can look at some of the other amenities.
Mr. Chairman, this will be my final comment.
Representative Garofalo, then coal calls.
Then what?
Coal calls.
Coal. Okay, gotcha. So, Representative Mark, I have to tell you, I'm even more confused by your comments now because you said multiple times we got to be in the ballpark. Got to be in the ballpark. Well, the income taxes in Minnesota now are 150% higher than they are in North Dakota for the top bracket, from 4% to 9.85%. And so I'm trying to figure out if we have a competitiveness issue. I think we do. I think that's why we voted to raise sales tax. Or I didn't vote to do it, but the Democrats voted to raise sales taxes. But more importantly, I think the message needs to be delivered that, and you said it best, that because there's not a deficit, that's why you're repealing these taxes. But if a deficit comes in the future and the Democrats are in control, they won't think twice about raising these taxes a second time. And I think that's a fair message that people need to understand. So, unfortunately, I need to run off to coal. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I've been listening to testimony on the last two bills, and we hear the fact that these programs have been in place for several decades. You know, I guess I would just point out that the oil boom and the fracking really didn't start till the millennia here. So I think this consistently states a very obvious point that we have consistently in Minnesota been uncompetitive with our neighboring states. I understand that North Dakota doesn't offer or did not in the past offer the level of services that maybe Minnesota chose to offer, and there's a cost to delivering that. But nonetheless, as we continue to keep doing what we've been doing over the last several years, you do drive businesses out of the state, and I think you've seen a natural migration of businesses going across the river, and that's why your sister city is growing. And to ignore that fact seems contrary to policies that we're putting in place. I said it before, it seems to follow that if you can buy off the opposition along the border cities with programs like this, we'll just plow ahead. And that's what this seems to be doing.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 3037? Representative Lean.
Mr. Chair, members of the division, I've laid out the unique situation that we're facing right now that we've been facing for the last 30, 35 years, and really this is more so, more than about state policies, this is really more about what North Dakota is doing right now in terms of its oil production and the Bakken oil play that they have run into. I think these two programs will be really productive and continue to make the northwestern Minnesota border continue stronger for the state as a whole. So I certainly do appreciate your time and consideration.
Thank you, Representative Lean. Representative Lincheski, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you had your hand up earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish Representative Garofalo were still here. I think the committee is having a hard time with this at this moment, and I will just tell you that my experience has been that in the time I've been here, you know, I spent 8 years in the minority and then 4 years in the majority and then 2 years in the minority, and now I'm in the majority, so I've mostly been in the minority. I have noticed that the legislators from this part of the state, and they've mostly been in the party opposite of Representative Lean, I might add, have always fought for this funding, these bills we've heard, and it has not been partisan. And pretty much both sides of the aisle have always recognized the unique circumstance that these communities are in. It's not just a state tax policy versus another state. It's literally a line drawn between a regional area that when you go there, you can't tell which city you're in. So I think in surpluses and deficits, in cuts and good times and bad, and I've been through them all and voted for billions in cuts and voted to raise taxes and voted to give it back and, you know, everything, we've always recognized that this is a microcosm economic group here that is independent of sort of the politics of these states and what they're doing. And so, you know, I would just hope as we think about these going forward, we could just remember that we really have not viewed this as sort of the D versus the R politics. It's just independent of that. And I am, having gone there when I first was in the legislature to look at it, I mean, I honestly couldn't tell when I left one community and went to another. And I think it's something that bipartisanly we've tried to assist these communities for a long, long time under multiple governors and multiple majorities. So I just want to put that on out there for people to think about.
Thank you, Representative Lincheski. Representative Lean, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Hansen, while you're coming up, the chair will move the minutes from the Friday, March 14th meeting with the following amendment incorporated. We met in room 300 North. With that, any discussion to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Oh.
It was
300
South. We weren't in North.
Thank you very much. The chair will incorporate 300 South into the minutes.
I concur.
We'll try this again then. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Hansen, the chair will move House File 2929 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome
members
to the committee.
Of the committee. House File 2929 deals with renters' property tax refunds, and I haven't served on this committee, but I've been on the tax committee this year and heard a lot of bills relating to business and gift tax and estate tax and cutting this and eliminating that, and I have a lot of renters in my district, and some of them are on fixed incomes, and we haven't gotten rid of inflation with the services that they or goods that they purchase. So I thought it would be something that we could provide some support to the renters throughout the state, wherever they're at, with a 10% increase based on the rent paid in 2013. So this is still the renters program where they have to apply for it, and it would be for 15 and 16, and it would cost about $21 million.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify regarding House File 2929? Questions from members? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this legislation change anything with regard to the phase-out of income limits that were agreed upon last year?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and Council could correct me if I'm wrong, but this is a one-time a change, and it would not affect that, is my understanding.
Representative Runbeck.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, sorry. Do you have an approximation of what the equivalency in a property tax reduction would be? Or, yeah, it's essentially the question. So we used to, I think the current law represents about 19% equivalency in terms of the rebate of property taxes. What does this one do? Do you know?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I do not know. I would defer to research staff if they have the answer to that.
Esteemed staff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, what you're referring to, I believe, is the annual research that the Department of Revenue conducts to see what percentage of rent is actually paid by property tax or as property taxes on a statewide average basis, and also then what we assume in statute for what percentage of the rent counts as property taxes. And really what Representative Hansen's bill is not affecting that at all. It's simply saying whatever the refund you qualify for, you're going to get 10% more than that amount because of this. And I don't really know how to equate it to the rent as a percentage of property taxes. It would vary where you were on the schedule. I don't know.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Runda. Okay.
Thank you.
I think I asked, but is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 2929? Representative Hansen, last comments.
It's a good bill. I hope it will be incorporated into the committee's recommendation to the full committee.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Faust, House File 3142. And while Representative Faust is approaching the front table, who brought the cookies?
Me.
You did? Oh, well, thank you very much, Ms. Thompson. They were just mysteriously here, and they're now going to mysteriously go away. So, please.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Loeffler?
I thought that those were the freshman treats you were bringing when you were going to present your bill.
I've presented before the committee previously. Thank you very much, Representative Loeffler.
Well, we talked the other day about some people may have forgotten way back when. And
True.
And I wasn't here when you were first here.
Of course, we did discuss bringing treats in full committee when I was presenting my micro-distillery bill. Yes. There was some interest amongst the committee, but the chair was adamant that wasn't going to happen. Representative Faust, would you like to move your bill, sir?
Yes, I would, please. Like
all right.
Bill 3142 for possible inclusion, I believe, is the motion that we are doing.
Yes. Thank you very much. Representative Faust, please proceed.
I do have two oral amendments, one on line 1.9. There's a blank right before percentage. We need to insert 3 in that spot. And in 1.12, we need to insert 6 before percentage.
All right.
So it'd be 3% and 6%.
Thank you very much, Representative Faust. So just to review so that staff and others have it, on page 1, line 9, in the blank, insert the number 3, and on page 1, line 12, insert the number 6.
Okay.
And Representative Faust, this is to get the bill in the form that the author Prefers?
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. Any discussion to the amendment? Hearing none. All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Faust, to your bill is amended.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is a pretty straightforward bill. We're not changing the parameters of who qualifies for these credits at all in any way, just increasing the homestead credit refund by 3%. So if they would have gotten $100 this time, now they'll get $103, and also increasing the renter property tax refund by 6%. So if they would have gotten $100 with this bill, they would now get $106 instead. So it doesn't change the parameters of who qualifies or anything like that, just straightforward increase to how much those credits would be.
Okay. Representative Faust, if I remember correctly, the last decade, property tax owners in Minnesota have seen an 84% increase in property taxes, and over the last 12 years, consistent increases, and that this is the first year after those 12 years that they will actually see a decrease in property taxes paid after they receive their credits. Is that correct?
That is correct, and this will make that decrease even larger.
Very good. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify regarding... Oh, Ms. Madden, I believe, is on the list. No fighting. Thank you. We can share. Ms. Madden, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. And I'd like to testify today in support of providing property tax reductions for low and moderate income Minnesotans through the property tax refund, both the renter's credit and the circuit breaker. So I appreciate Representative Hansen's bill as well. While we appreciate property tax refunds for both homeowners and renters, I'm going to speak primarily about the renter's credit today. I think many of you will remember that during last year's tax debate, you heard testimony about the difference that the renter's credit makes to more than 300,000 low and moderate income renters all across the state whose property taxes are high in relation to their incomes. You heard that the renter's credit is effective in limiting how much of their incomes these Minnesotans pay in property taxes, and how when they receive their refunds, these Minnesotans are able to catch up on bills and purchase basics like medicine, food, and laundry detergent in their local communities. And you also heard about the challenges that low-income Minnesotans faced when the renter's credit was cut by 13% in 2011. Last year's tax bill made important improvements to the renter's credit, and I thank you for considering an additional step this year that would provide a one-time property tax reduction for all Minnesota renters who qualify for the renter's credit. Low and moderate income Minnesotans still pay a higher share of their incomes in state and local taxes than those with the highest incomes, and we think we should continue to chip away at the regressivity of the tax system this year. I think this bill is an important step in that direction, and I encourage you to include it in your division report. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding this bill? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Mark Haven. I'm with the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence, where I research and educational organizations supporting sound tax policy and accountable government. Those of you who have served on this committee know for a very long time, for as long as our organization has been in existence, we've been staunch supporters of the property tax circuit breaker program, or the credit program, I guess it's called now. And we are deeply appreciative of that this group recognizes the value of that program as being the most efficient, effective way to deliver property tax relief to those who need it. That said, we're a little concerned that too much money is chasing too little a problem in this bill, or at least isn't being targeted in the right place. I have prepared a handout for you to give you some perspective on the generosity of Minnesota's circuit breaker program compared to all others around the country. It's first important to note that only 13 states do what we do, providing general homestead property tax relief regardless of age. A number of programs exist around the country targeting only seniors, but we're one of 12 states in District of Columbia that provide that type of relief. it's rather difficult to compare these programs because they each have their sort of equivalent of co-pays and deductibles in their design, which make apples to apples comparisons kind of difficult to make. But there are a couple of features that I think do capture our relative scope and generosity compared to other programs. If you look first at the maximum income eligibility, you'll see that Minnesota is far and exceeds most other states. Connecticut gives us a run for our money, but they max their refund at only $300. Similarly, income eligibility, income thresholds, where the affordability trigger is actually kicks in. You will see there that Minnesota now is at 1 to 2.5% of income, whereas most of the other states far exceed that, 3, 4, 5, even more percent of the income. It's in this context, especially in the context of recognition that Minnesota's homestead property taxes are in the middle of the pack in the nation. The VOSS database information, which just came out, suggests that affordability problems, the median tax burden that homesteads face, is quite affordable on an absolute and relative basis across most areas of the state. Because of that, we would urge that if additional supplemental circuit breaker money is going to be put into the system, it'd be more carefully targeted to those who need it. The VOSS database does identify there continue to be affordability problems at the tails of the distribution of some people paying 7, 8, 9%. That's where that money should be going, as opposed to focusing and spending it broadly across the homesteads of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Haverman, has your organization done any study that would take the exclusion that was adopted back in 11 and compare it to that reduction on what's taxable for property to the kinds of refunds that now those same folks might be receiving? Have you done any kind of study on that?
Mr. Haverman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, we have not.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Faust, we're getting into discussion with Mr. Haverman. I actually support your bill, but I do want to ask Mr. Haverman a question. I think you raised some good points, and the VOSS database I think is sort of the best we've got in Minnesota, and most states don't even have that to ascertain really what is the burden. And I think one thing that we share is your organization has repeatedly fought for direct property tax relief, like the circuit breaker and renter's credit, and I think has been a little more concerned about aid programs like local government aid or county program aid, if that's a fair assessment, kind of, that they're doing different things, really. One's reducing disparities and the other's affordability. And I hear what you're saying here, and having lived in a state that doesn't do any of these things, I can tell you they're not good states to live in. It's people who have resources have great services, and people who don't really don't, whether that's the schools or the roads or whatever. But I have to say, given what's going on in the property tax system, it just seems to me that the only way to really make a dent is the circuit breaker and the renter's credit. But for those programs, we would see that dial on property taxes continue to climb. And you stated that, we're in the middle of the pack of states, and that's true, but our residents don't think that, right? I mean, they just don't think that. And our businesses don't think that. And that's, that's a different issue because they're a higher classification rate. And I know you understand all this, but, it's troubling for me to try to think sort of then what if we were to infuse more money in the property, in the circuit breaker, and the renter's credit as opposed to these other aid programs or with them, how would you move the money around better? Because these proposals that I've seen from Representative Faust and Lean and talk to others, they really are trying to look at what is the VOSS database telling us. We are trying to measure what percentage of income people, hit. And we have some communities in the state that, they barely pay hardly any property taxes at all. And they don't even put in 1% of their income into property taxes, so they don't get a refund because, honestly, they're hardly paying anything. Right. But they feel like, they should get a bigger refund. So, I think you can think about all this together, what I'm saying. Do you have thoughts on future reforms? Because I think your organization actually has been a pretty big fan of these programs as opposed to other ways to do property tax relief.
Mr. Haverman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, the beauty of the circuit breaker program, I always use circuit breaker
yep,
program.
Me too.
It's ingrained and it's a chip in my head.
The homestead credit refund program?
Yes. Yes.
Anything you want to call it.
You know, we've always been strong supporters of it because it is targeted relief. And what I think we have concerns about here is that we can do a better job of targeting within the target, because the income testing is the way to go, in our opinion. But then allowing everyone who is eligible for this to tack on an extra 3 or 6%, we don't believe is the most judicious use of those resources when you have some folks out paying 7, 8, 9, maybe triggered by loss of a job, maybe triggered by death of an income earner or something of that nature. So it's those types of qualifications that we would like to see, if you are going to be investing more in this type of program, focus on those who are truly in the most need when it comes to property tax relief.
So, Mr. Representative Lynch, I mean, so if this were one-time money in these bills on renter's credit and Representative Faust, and that was a one-time, at least how I heard the authors testify on them, you know, this is one time, same people, give them a bigger check. But if it were not a one-time program, it was a permanent ongoing program, you're arguing, see if you can take some of that new money and put it in some other places. Is that, you know, kind of hit the people who are paying 9% instead of giving the people who have some burden, giving them a little bigger check? Is that the core of what you're saying?
Mr. Haverman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucheski, yes. The idea of targeting is very important.
Okay.
And to the extent that we can accomplish that in a continuing program, that would be the way to go. You know, this is still a significant amount of money that we're talking about here with this bill. And it just seems smart policy to us to, if we are going to supplement the already most generous, broadly accessible homestead refund program in the nation, it makes all the sense in the world to target it, that to those who are truly in the most need.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I probably should have asked this of Representative Hansen also, but I mean, around this table, we like to talk about tax policy. And I just wonder if Representative Faust, if you could articulate a policy that this bill is espousing. What's the policy idea here? Other than just throwing some more money at it.
Yeah, I guess.
Representative Faust.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that I would say that what it is it is generally across the board lowering the property taxes to homeowners and renters. I mean, that is what the purpose of this is, and so I think that, you know, because people pay property taxes whether they have a job or whether they lost their job or whatever, whereas income taxes will go up and down depending on how much they make, but property taxes have to be paid no matter what. And so I think that this is trying to lower the cost of property taxes across the board to everybody.
So, well,
Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair and Representative Faust, you know, there's no, like, cap or anything that you're incorporating. So, I mean, I guess I'm going to assume that there's kind of not a limit to how much we could do this to satisfy some on the other side of the aisle. I mean, do you see where enough is enough at any point?
Representative Faust, does your amendment serve as a cap?
Well, there's a specific amount of dollars that is going into this, and so, but I guess you're right. I mean, next year somebody could come back and say, well, let's do, you know, 6% was good, let's do 20%, and the next year they can do, well, let's do 80%, and so is there a point where you get to the point where you say, well, enough is enough? And I guess it's kind of like what Representative Vincheski said, you know, at some point in time people stopped complaining about it, and so it really is kind of more politically driven probably than a lot of things.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Representative Faust, any closing comments?
No, I think this is a good bill, and I hope that everyone supports it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I cannot move House File 2911 because the committee currently does not have possession of it. It's still in the Energy Committee where it passed unanimously about an hour ago. but we'll be coming to taxes. But we wanted to have an informational hearing since this does straddle both energy policy and tax policy. Mr. Chair, House File 2911 is an attempt to update state tax policy as it applies to the tax treatment of our solar industry. You'll recall that last year we passed a solar energy standard for investor-owned utilities, but we did not at the same time update the tax treatment of those solar inputs. Minnesota has had a policy that exempts solar energy photovoltaic devices for property tax, from property tax, but the definitions are now outdated. This bill will update the language to include solar energy systems, which is a more comprehensive definition of the components necessary for solar energy generation. In addition, this bill provides for a solar energy production tax in lieu of property tax for utility-scale systems. I've been asked if this will affect my neighbor who has solar panels up on the roof. No, it will not. The property tax exemption for those units will remain as is. This is for industrial-sized units only. This is modeled after the wind production tax, which provides for a payment based on energy production to host counties, cities, and townships. The solar energy production tax will be paid at the rate of $1.20 per megawatt hour for energy systems with a capacity of greater than 1 megawatt. Megawatt, I believe, is the technical term for really, really big. Wind pays at the same rate over 12 megawatts.
Minneapolis language. I like it.
1 megawatt for solar aligns with the net metering rules passed last year. The owner must file reports with revenue annually detailing the energy production. If they fail to do so, the Commissioner of Revenue will determine the tax based on nameplate capacity of the system multiplied by a factor of 30%, which is punitive. The solar production taxes will be distributed 80% to the county and 20% to cities and townships. If I could, but I can't, I would be offering an amendment to change page 2, line 9 from 60% to 30%. This was modeled after the wind production tax, and a multiplier of 60% is punitive for wind, but a multiplier of 30% is equally as punitive for solar. So just to draw out that parallel modeling. With me today is Mr. Nathan Franzen from Geronimo Energy, who can speak to the technical details of solar energy production in the state.
Welcome to the division, Mr. Franzen. Please state your name for the record.
Sure. Nathan Franzen. I'm the director of solar with Geronimo Energy. We're an Edina-based wind and solar developer. We primarily focus on utility-scale projects. We also do some commercial-scale projects. We support the bill, first of all. It really does two things. It cleans up some outdated language that doesn't reflect today's technology, which is important. And the second reason is that it provides clarity to the industry in terms of understanding what we can expect to pay for production taxes. And it also provides us the ability to communicate effectively with local governments on what they can expect to receive if they should approve a project in their jurisdiction. So it's fairly straightforward, and the industry supports the bill.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just trying to get a bigger handle on what really, really big is, because in my community there's some real excitement about another piece of legislation that passed last year called the Community Solar Gardens, in which you take a large flat warehouse or a large flat school building and you put on a solar array and then people can buy into it. Is that utility size? I'm just trying to get a feel for does this apply to what are called solar gardens?
Sure. Mr. Franzen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this bill would not apply, or it would apply, but the production tax would not apply to solar gardens because they are capped at 1 megawatt. The production tax would be for those systems larger than 1 megawatt. That portion of the bill would not apply.
Great. Thank you.
Is there anybody from the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Dabney, any closing comments?
No, I think we've covered it. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was really easy. That was really easy.
to the run back. Batting cleanup tonight.
I didn't run back.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, mostly because I'm, you know, I'm in boring black and whatever, red. I really wanted to be in green. And I was taking comfort in the fact that I think you're in brown, too. But then maybe that slight teal qualifies as green. Is that what you're thinking?
I always think of this as kind of my greenish suit. But maybe it's the light, or maybe it's my vision. Who knows?
Okay.
I have some green in my tie, definitely. Thank you, Representative Carlson. So do you. Yeah. Representative Nelson, did you have a...
I was just going to say, I think you made a slip. I think you called her Ryback, not Runbeck.
I don't believe I did that, Representative Nelson. Okay. Representative Runbeck, would you like to move your bill?
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'll move House File 2784 for possible inclusion. And this bill concerns itself with the Anoka County Joint Law Enforcement Council. They are a joint powers board that deals with public safety in the county. This section of law deals just with Anoka County, so we're talking about a very narrowly drafted bill. And what it would do is expand current law by allowing the county to use pay-as-you-go cash to pay off their bonds. So it's going to give them a little better bang for their buck. But I have with me County Commissioner Scott Schulte, and he can give us a little idea of what this is really going to do.
Great. Mr. Schulte, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. I'm Scott Schulte, Anoka County Commissioner. I'm also a former city council member in Coon Rapids for 12 years, where I served on the Anoka County Joint Law Enforcement Council, and I continue to do that now as a county representative. We're here today really simply asking if we can use cash to pay for a project instead of bonding. The legislature graciously gave us permission to bond for our public safety data system in its last session. And what we're attempting to do now is we've determined that we have enough cash internally to pay for this. And because there's a line item on the tax statement and there's legislation currently written that allows us to bond to pay that off, we need that legislation altered just a bit to say that we can pay cash. Simply, we don't want to use the credit card. We just want to pay cash, but we think the language is ambiguous in the legislation, and we could clean it up by having this this bill passed.
And, Commissioners, at this point, no bonds have been let. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair, I also have with me County Attorney Tony Palumbo. He has a comment or two to make.
Mr. Palumbo, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tony Palumbo, P-A-L-U-M-B-O. I am the Anoka County Attorney, but I'm here before you today in another capacity, and that is Chair of the Joint Law Enforcement Council. The Anoka County Joint Law Enforcement Council has been stated it's a joint powers board. It's been in effect since 1970. It is comprised of elected officials throughout Anoka County, as well as police chiefs. There's a fire representative and others, and county representatives. I serve as the chair. And as chair, I can inform you that the Joint Law Enforcement Council did approve the Public Safety Data System project in October 2013. And as chair of the Joint Law Enforcement Council, I am in support of this legislative change. I think it does allow the county the flexibility in providing this system to the county and the cities of Anoka County, and not only the police departments, but the fire departments, and working with the jail also. So I'm in support of the bill as rewritten here.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone? Commissioner Schulte.
Mr. Chair and members, if I could have one more comment. I talked with our finance director at Anoka County today and asked him, you know, what's the cost ramification if we can't get this legislation through and we have to bond? To go out for a bond for $5 million for 5 years, the cost to the taxpayer in Anoka County would be $600,000. $100,000 in issuance cost to pay bond attorneys, legal opinions, and then additionally $100,000 a year in interest. That's what we're attempting to avoid by paying cash. So it's really a savings of roughly $600,000 if we can pay cash and move this legislation through.
All right. Questions from members? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm one that my personal finances likes cash rather than debt, but I do have to ask, where does the cash come from? I mean, is it a reserve that the county has? I think we need to have a little explanation. I recall a school district that came in a number of years ago back of Hackensack that decided they wanted to use cash to add an addition to their elementary school, I think it was. And we found out that that was money that was supposed to be used for another purpose, namely educating the kids rather than construction. So if you could tell us where the $5 million is coming from.
Commissioner Schulte.
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Representative. We, Anoka County has an asset preservation account that we've developed recently where we've been putting money every time we develop more efficiencies within the county. We put money into our asset preservation account. So a good portion of it will come from that. Some of it will be coming from the $1 million line item that we've levied for the last 2 years for the public safety data system. That money has already been levied from the taxpayer. We have it in possession. We'd like to begin to start paying for this public safety data system, but the current law says we need to use it to pay for interest and bonding, not directly for the project.
Yeah, no,
Representative Carlson.
Chairman, I understand why you're doing the change. I just was interested in the source of the funding, so thank you.
And again, Mr. Chair,
Commissioner Schulte.
If Mr. Palumbo has anything else to add, I may not have all the data 100% correct, but again, it's from the asset preservation and from the current money we've already collected on that tax line item.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schulte, now I'm confused because the bill gives levy authority through December 31st, 2023, but you've talked about a five-year, $5 million program of which you've already collected 2 years' worth. So what beyond the public safety data system do you need levy authority for?
Commissioner Schulte.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this law is a rewrite of a previous law that authorized 800 megahertz radio upgrades, which had an expiration date. This, when it was rewritten, we didn't have any idea how long we would need, how much money we'd be bonding for, how long we would go out on the repayment plans of those bonds. Mr. Palumbo.
Mr. Palumbo.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. This originally was paid at the 800 megahertz system. Those payments ceased, I believe, last year. So we're using that same authority under this statute to pay for the public safety data system. And we're not sure exactly how long out that will be, but we will also be faced with 800 megahertz system once again as we go forward into the future. The county certainly would like to use this law to help pay for that sometime in the future should we have to face that.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that I know Representative Renbeck doesn't like us to levy more than we need to, and so I just wondered if the number of years should be kind of adjusted to reflect what you're planning.
Representative Renbeck.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, when this bill, hopefully it will be included in the property tax bill, I would like to have a conversation. It could be about that. But in addition, on page 2, line 9, my concern was that line says that the bonded, let's see, bonds or notes would not be included in the computation of the net debt of the county. And I think we have spoken with some folks, and that can be eliminated. And I think there's a concern there because with some of the new GAAP rules, and maybe Mr. Michael can talk about that, but the new GAAP rules really want more transparency and accountability at the county level, so to speak. So we would ask for that line to be deleted in a bill that would go forward. So there might be a discussion as well about the total number of years. I'm certainly be all right with that.
Representative Runbeck, do you want to make that as a motion at this time? It's your bill, ma'am.
Which are you referring to? The line 2.9?
I'm seeing, if I'm understanding you correctly, it would be on page 2, line 9, starting with the word notwithstanding.
Right.
And continuing through the period on page 2, line 11.
Right. Mr. Chair, yes, I would move to delete that line.
All right.
Committee.
Any discussion on the motion? Again, the motion is starting on page 2, line 9, with the word notwithstanding and continuing through, deleting through page 2, line 11, the period at the end of county. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Runbeck, any closing comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's a fairly concise bill, working off of existing language, and I think these gentlemen have a lot of experience with what they're doing with this joint powers board. So, encourage your support.
All right, thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you for coming down today. All right. At this time, the page will pass out the initial version of the division report. I will ask, once it's been distributed to everyone, for staff to do the walkthrough on the bill tomorrow. We will mark up the bill after hearing a couple of more bills. We've got our regular committee time beginning at 4 o'clock and have that room until 5:30, and then I believe if we need, we will recess and reassemble in another room. Ms. Locke? In 500 North.
Thank you.
At 5:45. But, of course, the chair's aim would be to try to complete things by 5:30 if possible. Tomorrow will be the day for debate, amendments, and, of course, speeches. There's always speeches. How does Ms. Dalton, Mr. Hines, who's batting leadoff here tonight?
Mr. Chair, we're trying to figure that out right now.
All right. I'll give you a minute. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Hines is going to start.
Thank you. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, members of the division, Article 1 is the AIDS credits and refunds article. Starting right out, Section 1 is the an increase in the agricultural homestead market value credit. Currently, it has a maximum of $345, although for most farms, it really caps out at $230, and this increases the credit to $490 for most farm homesteads. There's the formula's changed to accomplish that, and this is effective beginning with taxes payable in 2014. Maybe I'll just jump to describe that mechanism too. In Section 8 of Article 1, there's a provision so that because property tax statements for Article 14 are already too far gone to make changes in this, there's a refund mechanism whereby the counties will notify that the Commissioner of Revenue, who will issue checks to property owners who would qualify for a higher refund under this for 2014 only, and that mechanism is described in Section 8 of the bill. Section 2 is a increase in the disparity reduction credit. This is from Representative Lean's bill that we heard earlier today. It doesn't go quite as far as Representative Lean's bill did, but it reduces the effective tax rate from 1.9% to 1.7% on commercial, industrial, and apartment property in the four cities on the North Dakota border. Ms. Dalton will take from there.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Section 3 is the technical fix to the city LGA formula that was in Representative Lean's bill. Sections 4 and Section 5 essentially goes back to what was in the House bill last year on an LGA appropriation increase. The annual increase will be based on inflation plus population growth. However, in the bill last year, there was a floor of 2.5% and a cap of 5%. The floor has been removed. For pay 2013, this is an increase of 2.87%, or about $13 million more than what's in current law.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Section 6 is a new program of transition aid. This is pertaining to the report that we heard earlier on the equipment and property used in certain production processes. Primarily, this was the biofuels industry that brought a bill forward last year. We asked the Department of Revenue to conduct a study. They came back with recommendations, which we heard earlier in the session, and their proposal, which is also incorporated in Article 2 of the bill, to alter the statute somewhat to change how we tax that property, results in a loss of tax base for some municipalities. So this Section 6 provides for a transition aid mechanism for cities or towns that lose 5% of their tax base because of these changes, and I think the Department of Revenue's estimate is that this will only affect three cities or townships in the state, and they will get a transition aid equal to the amount of tax base they lose times the tax rate in the first year, and then it's scaled down by 20% each year, so basically a five-year phase-out of that transition aid program. Section 7 is a supplemental county program aid for 2014. We heard this bill earlier also, which provides that any county whose county program aid was reduced in 2014 over its 2013 level will receive a supplemental payment to bring them back up to the 2013 level. Again, that's a one-time only payment. Section 8 is the section I already mentioned, having to do with the increased agricultural homestead credit for 2014. And then Section 9 is an increase in the renter property tax refund and the homestead credit refund, and I think this is the same language that was in the Faust bill that we just heard, where it's a 3% increase for homeowners and a 6% increase for renters for 2014. For filed in 2014 or based on rent paid in 2013 and property taxes in 2014. Moving on then to Article 2, property taxes. Section 1 is the section I referred to earlier that is the clarification of how the various properties used in production processes would be taxed related to biofuels, dairies, and breweries, basically, to change somewhat the way we define what's real and what's personal property based on the Department of Revenue's recommendations. Section 2 is from the chair's bill that eliminates a number of minor property tax classifications. Section 2 is the one that eliminates Class 1D, residential property housing seasonal farm workers. Section 3 is also from that same bill, and it eliminates two classifications, one for some classes of some areas of property related to to privately owned airports with some public space, and then also Class 2E, which is land containing commercial aggregate deposits. Those two classes would be eliminated. Section 4 is a further elimination of some minor classes. The inns located in a municipality with a population under 2,500 in a city containing a state trail. Class 4, C, 7, and 8, non-commercial aircraft storage hangars located on or adjacent to publicly owned airports, owner-occupied bed and breakfasts, seasonal restaurants located on a lake, and marinas providing public access to a lake or river. Those special classifications are eliminated. Section 5, homestead of a disabled veteran or family caregiver. This was a bill that we heard last week, and that bill provided a permit. This affects the the exemption provided to surviving spouses of disabled, permanently disabled veterans. The bill that we heard called for them to permanently receive the benefit as long as they remain in that home. And this instead, this the division report increases from 5 to 8 years their qualification for that benefit. Section 6 is the Representative Loeffler's bill that we heard today, excluding the first tier of commercial industrial property from the state general levy and shifting the tax to the upper tier commercial industrial property. Section 7 is a bill that we heard last week also. I'm sorry, I don't have the references to the bill numbers, but this is a bill that extends the deadline for when counties and cities need to certify their proposed levies. Currently, they need to certify them by September 15th, and this just gives them a two-week extension to September 30th. And finally, Section 8, the repealer, repeals the aggregate preservation property tax law, which is the language that goes along with the Class E that we eliminated in Section 3.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Article 3 is the minerals taxes article, and all of the provisions in this article are from Representative Metz's bill that provided for funding the school facilities trust fund on the range. It does not, however, have the school finance provisions in it, which I believe will be carried in the K-12 finance bill. Section 1 of this article is the reduction in the filing requirement for individuals who receive royalties and will be subject to the royalty excise tax, lowering that threshold from about $10,000 to $500. This will mainly affect non-residents. Section 2 is a definition of royalty that's moved from the current withholding tax, withholding provision for royalties into the general definition section so that it can apply both to the excise tax and the withholding tax. Section 3 is the credit against the individual income and corporate franchise tax that's provided for the royalty excise tax. Section 4 is the section that actually imposes this new 5.5% excise tax on minerals royalties. Section 5 just corrects a erroneous cross-reference that was lingering in the statutes to the old royalties tax that was actually repealed in 1987. So it's being updated to refer to the new excise tax that would be imposed under this bill. Section 6 modifies the distribution of individual income and corporate franchise tax revenues to provide that the net revenues above the cost of collection and the credit from this royalty excise tax will go into the school trust fund to finance school facilities on the range. Section 7 is the withholding tax provision that requires payers of royalties, of mineral royalties, to withhold from all payments that are made to anyone other than an exempt entity like a governmental unit or a nonprofit, including C corporations. Section 8 is the provision that establishes the distribution from production tax revenues to this new school trust fund. So this is not the royalty revenue, but it's rather the production tax revenue. And there are a couple of items from existing production tax revenues that are going to be allocated to this account. In Clause 1, it's the increase in the escalator in the next 2 years. So to the extent that the increase in the production tax rate as a result of the inflation adjustment, that increase will permanently be allocated to this new trust fund. $2.5 million that now goes into the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Fund will also be reallocated to that fund. And then in paragraph B, there are a list of six current school district buildings that are being funded from the production tax. As their bonds are paid off, the revenues that have been used to pay for those bonds, for existing school district revenue bonds, will go into this into this school district fund account. Section 9 is the provision that says the corpus of the Douglas J. Johnson Trust Fund can be used to back up bonds that are being paid from this new trust account. Section 10 is a related provision that authorizes the corpus of the trust to be used for that purpose. Section 11 establishes this new trust account to finance school facilities on the trust on the range. Section 12 is the only provision in this article that is not from Representative Metz's bill. This is Representative Dill's bill that reallocates the money for Cook from the 2013 one-time distribution and also inserts the missing references to tons for those two distributions of the amendment that was made in committee. Section 13 repeals the withholding tax specific royalty provision that's no longer needed because of the new definition. Article 14 is the tax increment financing provision. Section 1 is a change in the five-year rule for under the 2010 jobs bill that provides that under current law, all of the districts that were certified within this window between June 30, 2003 and April 20, 2009 have a 10-year period of time rather than the normal five-year rule. This provides that for districts that period will end no later than earlier than June 30, 2017, so that for some districts will essentially give them an additional 2.5 years under their five-year rule. This general law change was done in lieu of specific provisions for the city of Mound for that Mound Harbor provision. So they will get an additional 2+ years of their five-year rule for this and for the city of Egan, which had also requested an extension. Both of those districts fall into this gap, and so under the general rule, they will get something like 2.5 years of additional authority to spend increment under their five-year rule. Section 2 is a provision that's in as a general law change that's put in to respond to a point that was made by the city of Shoreview. Later on, there's a specific provision for the city of Shoreview. This allows economic development districts to make the same fiscal disparities election that any other type of tax increment financing district can make. That means that these districts will be able to elect whether or not their fiscal disparities contribution will be paid out of increment or whether the city will use its tax base outside of the district to pay for that contribution. This change will allow essentially more increment to be generated for development from economic development districts. Section 3 is Representative Marquardt's bill for Detroit Lakes. Section 4 is Representative Mahoney's bill for the city of St. Paul River Center, changing the bonds that can be used to pay for that. Section 5 contains parts of Representative Mason's bill and Representative Atkins' bill for the city of Egan, for two TIF districts in the city of Egan. Paragraph A of that allows the city of Egan to uncap the original tax rate. They had also requested an extension of their five-year rule, which will be covered by Section 1 of this article, which gives them an additional 2+ years, not the 5 years that they requested. That bill also requested a 15-year extension of the time to collect increment. That is not contained in the division report. Paragraph B is Representative Atkins' bill, and that gives a 2-year extension to 7 years of the 5-year rule that Representative Atkins' bill had requested a 10-year extension. Section 6 is a special pilot project for the city of Shoreview. Shoreview, in its bill that Representative Isaacson had requested a 12-year extension of a pre-90 district. This instead gives the city a 5-year period in which to create economic development districts that have special rules essentially the city was asking for the extension in order to use to provide benefits to existing businesses in the city to retain them. This would allow them to create economic development districts that have a 12-year duration that's 4 years longer than the general law if they use it for businesses that are located in the city of Shoreview and that have percentage thresholds of highly paid employees engaged in manufacturing, research, or other professional occupations. And the wage threshold is that the wages have to be 25% or more of the median, and that 75% of the workers at those plants have to make, or at the businesses have to meet that threshold. They are also prohibited from using it for businesses that are basically retailers or providing services such as medical, financial, accounting, law, and so forth. In addition, the city is allowed to deposit up to 20% of the increment from these districts into a special fund that they will use for business retention of businesses that meet those qualifications, and to transfer money from this pre-90 district that they had requested the extension into that fund. That fund would, again, have to be used for those kinds of qualifying businesses.
Ms. Dalton.
Moving on to Article 5, local sales and use taxes. Section 1 is part of the bill that the City of Duluth requested. It allows the city to increase its current food and beverage tax by one-half of 1% to fund up to $18 million of capital projects related to tourism and recreation in West Duluth. It does not include the half-cent increase in the lodging tax to pay for promotion for recreation and tourism in West Duluth. Section 2 extends the time imposition for the City of Albert Lea's local sales tax. It allows them an extra 5 years to 15 years before the tax blinks off. However, there is no change in the use of funds or the maximum amount that may be raised. Sections 3, 4, and 5 relate to the authorizing the City of Baxter to extend its sales tax and to raise up to an additional $32 million plus bond costs for a number of projects. The projects are sanitary sewer and storm sewer and water projects, as well as transportation safety improvements. However, it does not include the street infrastructure projects that were in the original bill. Sections 6, 7, and 8 were from the same bill, but they are for the local sales tax in the City of Brainerd. Brainerd is being allowed to, with voter approval, extend its tax to raise an additional $15 million. The projects in the Brainerd are the same projects that were in the original sales tax authorization, the joint wastewater treatment facility, other water infrastructure, and trail improvements. And that will expire at the earlier of when $15 million are raised or 12 years. And then finally, Section 9 was the second part of the Albert Lea local sales tax bill, and it basically authorizes validation of their existing sales tax because they forgot to file with the state audit, the Secretary of State.
Mr. Michael.
Article 6 is the miscellaneous article. Sections 1 and 2 are Representative Runbeck's bill, which was just heard, and since we didn't realize the committee was going to amend it, the language on lines 43.26 to 43.28 will have to be struck to accommodate that amendment. Sections 3 and 4 are Representative Lean's bill for the Border City Enterprise Zone funding, with a couple changes from the way you heard the bill. Rather than $5 million, the annual allocation is reduced to $3 million. And rather than it being a permanent allocation, it's set for 5 years from calendar year 2019 2014 through 2019. Section 4 is as it was in Representative Lean's bill. Section 5 is a modified version of the Carlton County Levy for Soil and Water Conservation building. This was, as it was introduced, would have created a new special taxing district. Instead, this explicitly authorizes the county to levy for the cost of constructing that of that building through the loan from the USDA. And Article Article 7 is the department's technical property tax provisions. I'm not going to go through that, but I will highlight a couple changes. If you'll notice, there are a lot fewer pages in this than there were in the department's a bill. There are two things that were deleted. One, as the chair indicated to the committee when the bill was heard, the conservation easement provision was deleted. And secondly, the department had in its bill a large number of sections that attempted to make the statutory references to classification and class to be consistent. Rather than going through multiple sections of the statutes making those changes, there instead is a reviser instruction in the bill that directs the reviser in the next edition of the statute to make those changes. But other than those changes, I think this is all of the department's technical property tax provisions from its technical bill and policy bill.
Thank you very much. Ms. Schill. Ms. Schill, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Kathy Schill, House Fiscal Staff. I will be reviewing the three-page spreadsheet that was made available to you. It's entitled House File 1884, Delete All, and the version should be in the upper right-hand corner, KBS-6. The first page is the general fund fiscal implications, lines 1 through 43. Lines 1 through 5 are property tax refund changes. This is a reflection of Representative Faust Bill 3142 and Representative Hansen Bill, somewhat House File 2929, that you just heard today. The increase of 3% in the homeowner property tax refund and the increase of 6% in the renter property tax refund. The homeowner refund impact begins in fiscal 15 at a positive 12.1. And once again, I should have mentioned that these numbers are not revenue impacts, they are spending impacts. So make sure you read the small print that's at the very top of the page, where positive numbers are increases to program expenditures, negative numbers are decreases to program spending or cost savings. And the word negligible, NEGLI abbreviated for this sheet, means spending of less than $5,000 per year. Okay, so back to line 2. Homeowner PTR, the impact is a one-time impact that is mostly in fiscal 15, $12.1 million, and a little bit that falls over into fiscal 16 of $100,000. Line 3, renter property tax refunds, and both of these items have an asterisk after them. We're still seeking validation from the Department of Revenue because we had changed this particular one slightly. So I was just waiting for their response. So we'll still have this as preliminary, and it will become validated probably within the next day or so. Renter property tax refund at $12.5 million in fiscal 15, and once again, a small amount falling into fiscal 16. Lines 6 through 13 are the overall category of tax aids and credit changes. Line 7 through 13 are the changes to the local government aid provisions that are in the division report. This includes House File 2465 with Representative Lean, House File 2689 with Representative Simonson, and House File 1608 that we heard last year, and that portion would be the PTR, LGA inflation and population language that was added to the bill for a net change of 2.87%. The fiscal impact of those provisions are in the tails, $13.1 million in fiscal 16, $28.1 million in fiscal 17, and then you have both PTR interactions and income tax interactions. The total in LGA changes total $12.5 million in fiscal 16 and $26.8 million in fiscal 17. Moving down the page, lines 14 through 16, House File 2697 is Representative McNamara's bill. This is the supplemental aid for the county program aid. It's a one-time impact. This is that hold harmless provision. One-time impact in fiscal 15 of $740,000. Line 17 is the transition aid for business production property tax. This is the biofuels, the production tanks provision. And you'll see that this mirrors the governor's provision that actually provides aid in fiscal 17. This is aid to three particular cities. And there are additional details of for that transition aid. I know that, for example, it will not include cities that are currently located in Job Z zone, and it's mostly intended for current property tax relief, not future. Lines 18 through 21 reflect the border city enterprise zone allocation. This is Representative Lean's bill that you heard today, House File 2975. As Mr. Michael pointed out, this has been modified to what you heard today to be an allocation of $3 million per year starting in fiscal 16 for a duration of 5 years. There is a small interaction with property taxes, but it's listed as negligible, so the overall impact is $3 million per year. Lines 22 through 25 are Representative Lean's disparity reduction credit. Once again, it's been modified from what was presented today. This would take it from 1.9% to 1.7%. And once again, the first year of impact you'll see in the tails for fiscal 16 at $1.2 million. In fiscal 17, you have $1.2 million of an impact, but the interaction begins in that year, so the overall impact is slightly less. Lines 26 through 33 are Representative Marquardt's new agricultural homestead credit. And this, as Mr. Hines pointed out, would be a change to 1% of the market value with a maximum credit of $490 per taxpayer. This overall revenue estimate will be updated or validated by Department of Revenue. Once again, it's marked with an asterisk. So our best guess at this moment that this is that the supplemental credit payment will be in the vicinity of $15.1 million for fiscal 15, with a small amount, $40,000, in fiscal 15 for county administration. And then you'll see the actual market value homestead credit will begin in its normal calculation in fiscal 16 at $15.4 million. There's an income tax interaction associated with that provision
totaling a cost of $500,000. So the overall impact for the agricultural credit change would be in the vicinity of $14.9 million for fiscal 16. And then as you move into fiscal 17, it increases slightly to $15.2 million for a total change. Lines 34 through 36 represent Representative Davney's bill, House File 1884. You'll notice that it has been modified. The original revenue estimate included a PTR impact for the repeal of the managed forest program, but that is not included in this bill. Therefore, the bill itself, the overall impact is zero. Line 37 is Representative Purcell's bill, House File 2261. This is the Disabled Veteran Homestead Value Exclusion. The impact is, once again, in the tails. That is a cost savings because it's a value exclusion. It's a cost savings of $120,000 in fiscal 16 and $190,000 in fiscal 17. Line 39 is Representative Sudin's bill, 1895. This is the Carlton County Soil and Water Conservation Provision. This has a negligible impact in the tails. Total, you will see on line 41. For the 14-15 biennium, there's additional spending of $39,980,000 for fiscal 16 and 17, there is an overall impact of $77,850,000. Our target is only for fiscal 14, which is $40,000, so we are currently $20,000 under target. Page 2 are the no-cost items associated with the bill. You'll see on lines 43 through 70. We have a number of property tax changes included in this bill, including Representative Runbeck's bill, House File 2784, Representative Loeffler's bill, House File 2488. Once again, Representative Loeffler's bill, House File 2242, and the policy and technical provisions from the Department of Revenue also have no impact. Lines 53 through 70 cover the TIF provisions that are in the bill and the local taxes, local tax changes that are in the bill, all of which have no fiscal impact to the general fund. Beginning on line 71 and continuing through line 94, and that spans pages 2 and 3, we have an accounting of the non-general fund implications. And, Mr. Chair, I will tell you this, is that there is not a total at the bottom of this non-general fund presentation because we are still waiting on a revenue estimate, in particular for Representative Metz's bill. We have a lot of numbers there, but what we don't have is the estimate for the excise tax credit for the mining royalties, and that really is a matter that I know Department of Revenue is working very hard on right now. We do know it will be less than the $6.4 million that will be raised by the excise tax, and so exactly where it falls is yet to be determined. I'm sure that they will report to us. But you can see an accounting there on lines 76 through 70, or excuse me, 80, for the mining tax provisions, the excise tax, the tax credit, and then note that the Department of Revenue Administration will be included in that calculation prior to the net amount going to the IRRRB's new account for school construction and improvement. And then as each of the funds for the IRRRB as they exist, you'll see those on lines 82 through 94. We'll have some accounting to go through both the Douglas Johnson Fund and also the expired school bond payments that Mr. Michael mentioned, and then the Taconite Environmental Protection Fund. any questions on those, we can, we'll have more detail at a later point.
Thank you very much, Ms. Schiff. Joe.
Excuse me.
Members, there you have the division report. Again, we will mark up the report tomorrow after, I think it's two bills on the agenda. And so we can deal with questions, concerns, and the like at that time. Representative Runbeck, of course, would ask you to track the amendment that you did on your bill today to make sure to carry it over to tomorrow. And you may want to work with staff to have a written copy of this time rather than just do it orally as you did today.
Okay.
Right. With that, any questions? Thank you all. Please, if you would, thank you, Representative Carlson. Save your copies of the division report in the spreadsheet. I particularly want to thank nonpartisan staff. Needless to say, they always work hard, but I know many of them made a big push this weekend, and I personally am grateful and appreciative, and hope, confident I speak for the rest of the committee in sharing that. Thank you very much, and thank you all. With that, we stand adjourned.